It's the only book in the Bible where God's name is never mentioned. How surprising, then, to see his obvious handprints marking every page of Esther's story. Today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll continues his study of this fascinating Old Testament book. In this next portion of our study, we'll discover that although God's name is not identified, he's quietly orchestrating events, people, and circumstances that clearly illustrate his control. There's an encouraging correlation in principles that apply to your life and mine. Chuck titled this study in Esther chapter 7, God's Surprising Sovereignty.
In the previous message, we witnessed a subtle but pivotal turn of events. You may remember, the king couldn't sleep that night, so he had his servants read the historical records to him. But instead of curing his insomnia, the reading braced him like a pot of hot coffee. The mention of Mordecai's heroism prompted the king to honor this unsung hero. Ironically, the king had appointed Haman, Mordecai's sworn enemy, to herald Mordecai's praise of all things. When Haman returned home from the humiliating parade, he heard a different tune from his wife and friends than the one he had heard the day before. Instead of a festive dance, the sound of a funeral dirge was pounding in Haman's ears. As we observe this turn of events, we sense something more brewing, the deeper stirring of the sovereignty of God, arranging all events precisely according to his sovereign plan. These events usher us into a second banquet mentioned in chapter 7. In preparation for today's message, I want to read from Esther chapter 7. Verse 1 begins, "Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, 'Oh, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done.' Then Queen Esther replied, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king.' Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, 'Who is he, and where is he who would presume to do this?' Esther said, 'A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman.' Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?' As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, 'Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king.' And the king said, 'Hang him on it.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which had been prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided."
listening to Insight for Living. To search the Scriptures with Chuck Swindoll, be sure to download his Searching the Scriptures studies by going to insightworld.org/studies. And now the message called God's Surprising Sovereignty.
I've never met a person who didn't feel pity for Job. I mean, here was a man godly in heart and righteous in life and lifestyle who had his entire world crash in on top of him for no apparent reason. And the pain became unbearable. And all because of satanic cruelty and God's strange allowing of it to happen, the man became like a tiny wounded mouse in the paws of a big cat. Almost played with. And the hardest part of it all was not the pain, that was bad enough, but it was this mysterious sense of God's silence which played out in Job's life as God's absence. It occurred to me that it must have been like swimming on a vast lake and getting about 100, 150 yards offshore toward dusk, and suddenly a freak fog rolls in over the lake and surrounds you. And you're trapped in this tiny circle of sight. But the fog has diffused light, so you can't even tell where the sun is going down. And you begin to swim. You think toward the shore, but you're not sure. And then you turn and you panic and swim in another direction, and you again have lost your orientation. You don't know where land is. You panic. Your heart rate increases, and you decide maybe to float to conserve strength, and it gets dark. And the only way you're going to be safe is by hearing a voice. Faint though it may be, you need a voice. You need to have someone calling from the shore. And you could then point yourself in that direction and swim rapidly and find safety and comfort and relief. Something like that sense of lostness swept over Job as he sat in the rubble of what was once a beautiful landscape. His ruined ranch was before him, and his children now fresh graves on a windswept hill. He lost everything. Everything he owned, virtually everything he was, and now finally his health. And he sits in ashes, and he cannot hear God's voice. It's like a fog. It's like a tiny little space of sight, and not knowing where, to say nothing of why. That he writes in his journal, third chapter, words that could easily be criticized by people sitting in a place of comfort, good health, and ease. He opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth and said, "Let the day perish in which I was born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived." Verse 11. "Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire?" Those are words from the lake. Those are words in the fog. Those are words that come from a man who doesn't know why, and God won't speak, and he is alone, and he is worse than dead. He is alive in his misery. Look at the end of that third chapter, verse 24. "My groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water For what I fear comes upon me and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, for I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. Don't criticize Job until you've been there. It is the worst kind of existence. Bad enough to have everything gone and to have your body covered with sores from your head to your feet, but to hear no voice from God. From that moving account of a man's misery, let me shift gears to a realm that is not nearly so measurable and realistic. Let's move from this real world to a realm some might call philosophical. And for the next few minutes, I want you to think with me about time. Time. I would like to contrast our time with God's time. You and I are locked in a cage that causes us an enormous amount of struggle and confusion. We are in a tiny space on this lake of life called the present. Because our entire perspective is gauged from this moment where we find ourselves, we speak of the past and the future. Because our world of time, to begin with, is objectively measured. You want to know the hour or minute of the day? You look at your watch. You want to know the day of the week? You look at your calendar. Easily marked, carefully measured. You want to know the past year? You look into the diary or the journal you've been keeping, and you have a record of how things were. Objectively measured. Second, time for us is consciously accountable. Events are seen. They are dated. People are visible. Things are tangible. It is in a realm of sight, smell, touch, hearing, feeling. It is a very real realm, this accountable realm, and if we want to get it straight, we can ask several others who are accurate witnesses, and they saw it, or they were there, and they can account for it. It is in a world of the tangible and the visible. Third, time is rarely ignored or overlooked. Oh, we daydream, and we sleep. But aside from those momentary lapses, we may have a little mental lapse in the midst of a busy day where we lose track of time, but not often. Most of us know about every hour of the day pretty close to the exact time, because that is our world, and it is very real, measurable, and understandable, and conscious. God is not like that at all. His workings are not on the basis of that. As a matter of fact, we are in this realm of life on planet Earth that has its own realm of time, and you leave it instantly when you move beyond it, and He lives beyond it. I thought of this when I read this account. On the night of February 23, 1987, an astronomer in Chile observed with his naked eye the explosion of a distant supernova, a blast so powerful that it released as much energy in 1 second as our sun will release in 10 billion years. Did that event truly occur on February 23, 1987? Well, only from the perspective of our planet. Further investigation revealed, actually the supernova exploded 170,000 years prior to our 1987. But the light generated by that faraway event traveling almost 6 trillion miles a year took 170,000 years to reach our galaxy. And we noticed an explosion. God is in that realm. There is no night where He lives. Maybe you heard the comic story of foolish scientists who made plans to send a rocket to the sun. Someone said, You're going to burn up. No, they answered, we're going at night. God has no night. God has no day. God has no month. God has no year. God has no past, present, or future. He transcends it all. And he operates in a realm that is transcendent. We see history like a sequence of still frames moving from one to another, like the passing of a movie. God sees all the movie, all at once, in a flash, along with millions and trillions of others going on at the very same time. He is beyond it all, which makes our little bit of space on the lake seem terribly much like a cage called time. Isn't it easy to sing it? In his time, God makes all things beautiful in his time. It's 11:45, Lord. Lord, please show me every day. He has no day. That you're teaching me your way. He has a way. And you do just what you say in, now we're talking, your time. Now, immediately we have a problem. Our problem is that we read life wrongly. It must be read in the panorama of God's mind and through God's perspective, but we are finite creatures. So we are left in a fog. Philip Yancey, in one of his best books, Disappointment with God, writes, no matter how we rationalize, God will sometimes seem unfair from the perspective of a person trapped in time. Only at the end of time, after we have attained God's level of viewing, after every evil has been punished or forgiven, every illness healed, and the entire universe restored, only then will fairness reign. Then we will understand what role is played by evil and by the fall and by natural law in an unfair event like the death of a child. Until then, we will not know and can only trust in a God who does know. He continues, we remain ignorant of many details, not because God enjoys keeping us in the dark, but because we have not the faculties to absorb so much light. At a single glance, God knows what the world is about and how history will end, but we time-bound creatures have only the most primitive manner of understanding. We can let time pass. Not until history has run its course will we understand how all things work together for good. Faith, then, means believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse. And that's hard. That is hard. It's as hard as moving from the chorus, in his time, God makes all things beautiful in his time, on Sunday, to the real world of pain and loss and hardship and earthquakes and floods and death on Tuesday or Wednesday or Friday. So what do we do? How do we live in a fog without panic? How do we make it in this little space, not knowing where the shore is, and especially during the times when we do not hear a voice? Well, we need help in discovering how God works. The book just before Job is the book of Esther, and it's quite a book. It's the only book in the Bible where God isn't named, but you haven't had to worry about that because I've named him all the way through these messages, and I brought to your attention the ending of the book. You see, they didn't know about it in the third chapter or fourth chapter. I've read the book, and you have too. And so we're able to read in reverse and give them peace and comfort and tell Mordecai to wait and rest and to tell Esther she'll move when it's God's moment Because we're able to read it into it because we have the book. And the book is written from the perspective of no planet specifically, but God's transcendent presence generally. So when we come to chapter 3 and we find that there's a sustained period of silence where the king promotes Haman, you and I want to say, no, don't do it. You'll be sorry. He's a bad guy. He hates the Jews. He's going to work out a murderous plan. Don't promote him. But he promotes him, and there's no voice from the shore. Verse 6 of chapter 3, he seeks to destroy all the Jews who are in the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And the king of all things plants his ring in the clay, and he sends the message by edict across the kingdom of Persia, and the Jews now live in the fear that they will die by the end of the year. And God's silent. He doesn't say a word. He doesn't speak. He doesn't even stop them. Must have been like living in Paris when the Nazis came. How could they come? How could they take us? We are Frenchmen. But they came. And they killed. And God was silent. Mordecai tries to motivate Esther and she's hesitant. And we want to say, Esther, get at it. You're the queen. You can make a difference. I know. I read where you did a little later. Do it. And she doesn't do it. Not right away. And God is silent. She asks that they might fast and pray for her, and they do, and she decides to do something. And in the meantime, Haman, aggravated at Mordecai, builds gallows that are going to hold the carcass of Mordecai till he rots. And nobody stops him. Let me tell you something. Had we lived then in that little place of the lake, we'd have wondered, where is God? Just like Elie Wiesel in his book Night stands as a child, viewing all the sights of death and smelling it from the ovens. And the man behind him says, where is God now? Of course. You know, such periods of silence are woven all the way through the text. And if you don't know this, and if you don't remember this, and if you don't call this to mind when he stays silent while you are on the lake, you will panic, you will doubt, you will become cynical. Your faith will remain like a little tiny mustard seed.
We've seen this tragic pattern of anti-Semitic behavior from Esther's day until now. And whenever it rears its ugly head, it begs the question, why does God seem to remain silent? Well, let me urge you to keep listening when Chuck Swindoll provides a biblical answer. You're listening to Insight for Living, and today's message is titled, God's Surprising Sovereignty. And you can find the downloadable audio file when you go to insightworld.org. Nearly every day, you likely hear me mention a resource at the beginning of the program called Searching the Scriptures. There's no cost to access this deep collection of online study notes. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised when you go to insightworld.org/studies. These interactive study tools were inspired by a book Chuck wrote, also called Searching the Scriptures. Not long ago, we heard from one of your fellow listeners in Missouri who tapped into these resources. I'll read a portion of her letter that began with, Dear Brother Swindoll, I want to share with you how your ministry has impacted the lives of so many at our church. I heard your book, Searching the Scriptures, described on your radio program, but was driving, got busy, and forgot about it. Later, I felt God was telling me to use your book as a guide for our women's Bible study. And so I requested a copy. There are no words to adequately express my personal thank you for a book that has been consumed now by over 100 women as we met weekly to discuss your book chapter by chapter. God used your sweet book to teach us how to observe interpret, correlate, and best of all, to apply the Word to our lives. Thank you so much. Well, your letter is an encouragement to us all. And let me invite you to check out the many study tools available for digging deeper into God's Word, including our current study in the book of Esther and the Searching the Scriptures book. Go to the online store at insight.org/store. Or if you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. That's insight.org/store or call 800-772-8888. Take it from Chuck Swindoll. There's nothing quite like the beauty of the great frontier.
Wide open skies, pristine glaciers with various shades of blue and turquoise mingled within them, towering pine trees, and all manner of wildlife. I'll tell you, Alaska is truly a masterpiece of God's creation.
I've been to a lot of places and seen a lot of things, but honestly, nothing compares to the beauty in Alaska. God is awesome.
Please plan to come with us on Insight for Living Ministries' 40th anniversary cruise to Alaska. It will be held June 29 through July 6, 2019.
When I'm in Alaska, I feel like I'm in an amazing painting created by God.
Let yourself get lost in the majestic beauty. Spend quality time with those you love. Allow God to refresh your soul as you reflect on His Word and His goodness in your life.
To learn more, go to insight.org/events or call this number 1-888-447-0444. The tour to Alaska is paid for and made possible by only those who choose to attend. Join us Wednesday as Chuck Swindoll continues our study about God's surprising sovereignty, right here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, God's Surprising Sovereignty, was copyrighted in 1989, 1990, 1997, 2005, and 2018. And the sound recording was copyrighted in 2018 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.